Good morning. So I love that reading from Reverend Riley and that statement at the end that 2 centuries later we're still grappling with the implications of that radical understanding, that love that we want to manifest. And this year at USG, one of the other things we have been grappling with is the point of that book, which is how to be a powerful, justice-seeking congregation. And we've had a task force, because, you know, there's going to be a task force. So we've had a task force working on revisioning, revitalizing our social justice effort. And yesterday was more or less a centerpiece of that process, where we come together to talk about not only what do we want to do in the world, but how do we want to do it. And there were 45 of us that spent the day in the lovely, sun-filled Sullivan Chapel, a beautiful space, talking about what issues we want to work on. And not just how we want the outside world to be changed by our efforts, but how we want to change. Because the justice work isn't just about changing other people. It's about changing us too. And as a starting point, I asked our good Reverend Kent Mathias to give us a little bit of history and his thoughts on our mission. And I like that he held up that our history is mixed. You know, we've done some amazing work. USG started the Nicetown Boys and Girls Club, which has been in the news a lot recently because Phillies outfielder Shane Victorino just gave them $900,000 to completely rehab the facility. But we started that program in, I think, about 1905 or 1906. The church has also done a lot of great work over the years with civil rights, with hosting Hungarian refugees that were fleeing persecution. But there was also a time in the history when we had this forum that would discuss issues to meet, and the people in the forum wanted to move it from just talk to action, and the board said, no. Actually, we're just going to keep it with the talking. We don't want to do the action piece. And so the church has always been involved in the community, but what that involvement has looked like has ebbed and flowed. And there's a great consensus here, and I've certainly felt that we do want to play a powerful role in this community, in this state, in this nation. That's kind of why I was brought on in part to do this process. And the passion is clear. And Ken ended his words with us by offering what, if he was forced by a higher power to do so, would be his one-sentence mission for the congregation. If he was absolutely put on the spot, one sentence all, buddy, what is it? His answer is that our mission is transforming lives as people dedicated to love. People transforming lives as, or transforming lives as people dedicated to love. So let me take that a little bit deeper into our history. Because our current Unitarian Universalist religion comes from an incredible tradition of women and men whose conscience and courage led them to publicly articulate views that were prophetic and powerful and often wildly unpopular. And this is one of those stories. It comes from Hosea Ballou, one of the most influential figures in early American Universalism. And he wrote his famous essay, The Doctrine of Universal Salvation, in 1849. Now, at that time, the rising tide of universalism was strongly, strongly opposed by the Calvinist institutions that had dominated for so long and who believed that only some people were saved and that everyone else was going to be eternally punished. Now, for Ballou, the most relevant biblical text was from the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 22, verses 37 to 40. where to test Jesus, a Pharisee asks him, which commandment in the law is the greatest? And Jesus' response is, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the greatest and first commandment, and a second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments hang all of the law and the prophets. For Ballou, whether or not someone is actually fulfilling these commandments comes down to intent. If the reason you're loving God and loving your neighbor is simply to avoid hell, then you are not satisfying the commandment, because you're not acting out of love as God has commanded. You're acting out of fear according to your own personal concern. And so Ballou's point, his universalist gospel, is simple. We are called to act out of love. We are called to act out of love. And so when Kent suggests that our mission be transforming lives as people dedicated to love, he's not just casually throwing out something that he just thought of or that is new to our tradition. He's doing precisely what Reverend Riley says is necessary. He is grounding our mission in the deepest part of our theological tradition. And so if we're called to act out of love, the question becomes, what do we do? And there are, of course, many different types of action in the world. Two things that readily come to mind for most congregations are service and education. And this congregation has a lot of amazing programs going on in those areas, from working with the Interfaith Hospitality Network and the Neighborhood Interfaith Movement to educating people about environmental issues and things going on in the international arena. We're doing that very well. And that's great and it's important, but it's not enough. Because service and education don't change structures of power. They don't address the root causes. And if we take our values seriously, like the UU principles, that we believe in the inherent worth and dignity of all people, that we affirm justice, equity, and compassion in human relations, that we support the goal of world community with peace, liberty, and justice for all, that we show respect for the interdependent web of existence of which we are all a part. If we believe in these things and take them seriously, some things are going to need to change around here. Because our world does not affirm those values. For us to make them happen, we have to choose to make them happen, and we have to do something about it. In our congregation, in our community, in our state, in our nation. And you may not realize this, but there's only one word of substance that appears twice in the UUA principles. Any guesses what it is? It's justice. Justice is the only word that appears twice in the seven principles which define our religious association. Now, clearly, I am passionate about justice. I think you probably get that. But I'm also passionate about the other aspects of our faith that make us a congregation. And so I want to tell you about how justice fits into that, in my view. Now, justice at its worst can mean that we're isolated and we're too self-righteous to connect with people. So how do we ground it in the other things that we do? And one of the things that I said when I started our workshop yesterday was that the one thing we all have in common in that room and in this room is that we are connected to this congregation, this Unitarian Universalist congregation. And so the way we do our justice work has to take that into account. We are not a secular advocacy group. We are a community of faith. And so that in addition to doing justice work, we also need to build community and we need to nurture the spirit. And everything that we do I think, should build relationships among us and with the outside world. It should give us opportunities to be vulnerable, to share deeply what's in our hearts, to really connect with each other. That's community. And it should also build spirit. We build spirit here in worship. We build spirit through spiritual practices, either alone or in groups. But that is what defines us, in part, as a faith community, is that we stand in a tradition of worship and of engaging with the holy, however we define that. And so community and spirit need to be part of our justice work, but also our justice work needs to be part of building community and spirit, which means that when we're in worship, we still need to think about justice. When we're in small group ministry, we still need to think about justice. Each of those things, community, spirit, justice, should be woven throughout everything that we do. And yeah, not every single activity is going to have all three. That's fine. But if we can keep that in our consciousness, we will be, I think, more true to our calling as religious people, we'll be more effective, and I think we'll get more out of it. Now, one of the best things about community and spirit, and this really came out yesterday, is that it keeps us from feeling overwhelmed. That when we're doing something together, it feels more manageable. And of course, it's easy to feel overwhelmed if you think you have to do something alone. Now, it's also easy to feel overwhelmed if you don't have a clear sense of what you're doing or why. And that was a central question that we talked about yesterday. What are we going to do, and why are we going to do it? And we actually came up with some pretty clear priorities. And basically, we have two core priorities that are going to be with us in some shape or form for some years that we're hoping and expecting the whole congregation to engage in some way. And then there's two sort of secondary priorities that will be around at a lower level but still have a fair amount of support and buy-in. Priority number one, education. We already have great partnerships on the issue with local schools, with tutoring programs, with community organizations. Our challenge now is to ramp it up from a lot of service and education to advocacy and organizing and policy change. It's to ask the question, why do these kids need tutoring in the first place? What's wrong with the schools? What's happening in their home life? Why are their parents working three jobs and still not making enough money to put food on the table every day? And I want to share a story about one of our forebears, Horace Mann. So Horace Mann was alive and wrote in the early 1800s, and he, perhaps more than anyone in this country, is known for advocating for universal, free, non-religious schools, which was not popular at the time. And in fact, many on the religious right still today credit or discredit him, depending on how you want to say it, with secularizing public education. And he became a Unitarian, but that's not where he started out. He was raised as a Calvinist. And when he was 14, his older brother, Stephen, older than him by 4 years, drowned. And at the Calvinist funeral for his brother, Stephen, the minister was going on and on about how people who were not yet converted would go to hell. And Horace saw his mother's suffering in that service, and at that point decided that he was done with Calvinism. He was done with a creator that could be so cruel. And he commenced his lifelong belief in the kindness and ethical integrity of God. So he did his work because he was dedicated to love as a deep and very painfully reached faith commitment. Now, the other issue we've picked, in addition to education, is the environment. And this congregation's Green Sanctuary program has and continues to do phenomenal work in a lot of areas on this. We have great partnerships, including a partnership now with the UU Pennsylvania Legislative Network, of which Kent Mathias is the president, and environment is one of the three issues they're focusing on. So we have a lot of opportunity to work there. And again, I want to ground this commitment in a little bit of our history. So one of the books that all seminary students are required to read is called Three Prophets of Religious Liberalism. And one of the essays in there is Ralph Waldo Emerson's Divinity School Address, which he preached to a crowd of, at that point, mostly Unitarian seminarians who were graduating from Harvard Divinity School. And to say that it was unpopular is a gross understatement. It created a firestorm that changed that school and frankly, religion in this country forever to a certain extent. And so this is one of the things that Emerson said to that crowd of new ministers. I once heard a preacher who sorely tempted me to say, I would go to church no more. A snowstorm was falling around us. The snowstorm was real, the preacher merely spectral. And the eye felt the sad contrast in looking at him, and then out of the window behind him, into the beautiful meteor of snow. He had lived in vain. He had not one word intimating that he had laughed or wept, was married or in love, had been commended or cheated or chagrined. If he had ever lived and acted, we were none the wiser for it. The capital secret of his profession, namely to convert life into truth, he had not learned. Not one fact in all his experience had he yet imported into his doctrine. So there's two things that I take from this. One is that I'm always nervous when it's snowing when I'm preaching. And the second is just the great contrast between the snowstorm as real and the yammering about doctrine that was not real. Because for Emerson, more than any other figure of his time, life was happening now, and life was happening in nature. And that God and the holy and life and transcendence wasn't to be found in books, or at least in books exclusively, but in the world, in life, in experience. So our faith's focus on living in this world, in ways connected to other people and to nature, is deeply, deeply ingrained in our religious tradition. Now, as secondary priorities, we picked economic justice, which the church has done and is doing a great deal on, and women and reproductive freedom. And I want to share a little bit of my story, especially on this topic of reproductive freedom. Now, I grew up in the Unitarian Church of Harrisburg and was very active in my youth group. And probably one of the first justice-oriented things that I can remember doing in my life, and certainly with my congregation, was attending the 1992 March for Women's Lives in Washington, D.C. And this was hundreds and thousands of people demonstrating for different aspects of women's rights, for reproductive choice, among other things. And it was an overwhelmingly transformative experience for me, in part because of what happened there, and the slogans and the bumper stickers and the people. And I got so inspired that as a 14-year-old boy, I joined the National Organization for Women. seem like a great idea, and I think it was. But it was also transformative to be there with my youth group, essentially with my faith community. And that pretty clearly helped me to understand some of the reasons that you know, my faith had views that were different from my peers, but also that justice work was something that we did, and it was something that we did together. And when I went back the next year with my youth group for the 1993 Equal Rights March for gay, lesbian, and bisexual people, it didn't feel as new, but it felt just as right and just as important. And I don't know if I would be here or be in the ministry had it not been for this connection of justice and faith, had it not been for my feeling that we don't just do church here together on Sunday mornings. We do church out in the community, and we stand for something. And so as we move forward with these priorities of education and the environment, I invite you, I encourage you, I challenge you to find at least one way that you can be involved, that your family can be involved. However big, however small, these are huge issues. There's so many opportunities to be involved. Pick something. And if you're feeling overwhelmed with the options, talk to someone. Ask what you can do. Working together is a great way to not feel overwhelmed, and it's a great way to actually make a difference, to make justice, to build community, and to build spirit. So friends, let's get to know each other. Let's talk about who we are and why. Let's talk about our beliefs and what inspires us. Let's talk about how we want to change the world with our justice work and how we want to be changed by it. Let's transform lives as people dedicated to love. Amen.